I thought that would just be something fun to think about. Wouldn't that be nice? All right, so as you know, I'm a little bit behind because of the tangents and our snow day still, so we'll try to catch up today. Today will be a catch-up day somewhat. You can start to exercise your hands maybe if you're writing, or at least wake up somehow so we can get through some of the material. But just to remind you, you know, everything's on the webpage. Some people join the class a little bit late or with drop ad, and you know, we're putting the PowerPoints up there, the echoes, some music for you so you can relax. That's really good. All right, so everything's up there on the webpage, and I try to post the PowerPoints as we go along, and the echoes in the podcast usually go up about 20 minutes after this class, so they're usually posted right away as well. Okay, so that's that. And so what happened? You had lab. Some of you had lab on Monday, right? And you worked with crayfish and little chambers. And some of what did you do? Did some of you heat them up or cool them down? Cool them down. Okay. Did you see a change in metabolism? Yeah, had an effect. Which tells you what? These animals are homeothermic or heterothermic? Heterothermic, right? Or ectotherm are the other terms that you might use too, or cold-blooded, warm-blooded. Those kind of all go together, right? Warm-blooded, cold-blooded. Ectothermic means the same thing as like cold-blooded, right? In the literature. And then I think as you go through that sections, like section 3, then you see section 1 and section 2 data, right? Yes. So then it can combine together. And I don't know if Wednesday, if they're going to put up a new set of data, so like you're a new group, or if you're going to still see section 1, 2, and 3. I think they want to start it over again on Wednesday, so then they have those three sections on Wednesday as well. So the lab, the first lab is to get used to the software, get used to getting in the lab and getting things organized. Remember you have those quizzes right the night before. Try not to forget to do those. I tried to send you out an extra email to remind you. Make sure you get that done. And for Wednesday's section, when is it going to be due? What's today? Yeah, that's right. Okay. Tonight, right. So you want to get that done tonight if you can. It's not so bad, right? For those people that had it already, was it so bad? No? Not so bad, right? So just go ahead and maybe look over the lab and do the quiz. And I think the quizzes are different for every section, pretty much, or some different questions, too, right? So look through that. Any questions on the lab content? Is everybody good with lab? No, I didn't go to lab yet. No. Yes, we did have lab on Monday, in case you forgot it. Okay. And remember those safety tests. If you didn't finish those safety tests, you're supposed to get those done too. Supposedly the TAs were not to let you finish the lab until you've done it. But if you haven't done those labs yet, the TA test, that little safety test for the lab, make sure you get that done as well. And then they hopefully went over the lab component and the writing assignments that you have to do. Right? GCCR? Yes. Yes. Okay, everybody's awake. Good. We're going to have to get coffee for everybody, I think, you know, sooner or later. We'll have to get some things up. Okay, so what are we doing today? We started metabolism, and this is the way every physiology course really goes through, understanding the cellular level and then bringing that up to systems. And then we talk about each of the systems, right? Well, it's easier to cover one system at a time, like cardiovascular, neuro, renal, GI. But if you look at how the change in education is really going on at med schools, for example, they're trying to make it integrative. So you kind of go throughout the systems together. But it's a little bit hard to do that if you haven't covered the systems enough yet, because you can't understand ion balance until you really understand how the kidneys work, right? So we'll try to integrate it back and forth, but I don't want to jump to other content with that we haven't covered yet. So we'll still try to cover it system by system. So we're going to finish cell metabolism, just get you in the mindset, and then begin on membrane function, and then usually, all physiology textbooks usually start with the nervous system next, because it's easier to explain electrical potentials. So that's where we're going. So we're going to wrap up where we were last time. How is ATP an energy molecule again? What does it do? Transfers the phosphate to do what? what's the key word we're looking for?
Phosphorylation.
Phosphorylation, exactly. So it phosphorylates enzymes, are other proteins. Remember, enzymes are proteins, and they can turn on a function, turn off a function, can make the pump work. What's probably the most energy-demanding process in you right now? Key things to remember. Probably your sodium-potassium pump, right? Generally around 3 to 2. You probably memorized that by now, too. Right, for 3 sodiums, 2 potassiums. Which way is it working? Is it pumping sodium in or pumping sodium out of a cell, usually? Pardon? Anybody? Sodium in? Sodium out? Sodium out. Because sodium's higher on the outside already, right? So it wants to go down its concentration gradient. We're going to talk about electrical gradient later. But it wants to go down the concentration gradient. So you need a pump. You need energy to go against the concentration gradient, right? So this is what the pump's doing. And potassium is usually higher inside cells than outside cells. So you're trying to pump potassium against the concentration gradient. And that's why you need ATP, right? So it's going against that concentration gradient. It requires energy. Okay. So we kind of covered some of that part. Now, I think I already told you we don't want to memorize every little step in the glycolysis and TCA, electron transport chain, but we want to know the big pictures. What were some of the big pictures? The big pictures, where does glycolysis take place?
Cytoplasm.
Cytoplasm, right. Okay, fantastic. Cytosol. And one glucose broken up into two pyruvates, right? And now we have these two pyruvates that can enter in the cycle, which has three different names. Basically, it's all the same. What is it? TCA, Krebs cycle, citric acid cycle. It's all the same, right? So it enters into the TCA cycle, citric acid cycle, or Krebs cycle, because Hans Krebs described it. And then from there, we go on into the electron transport chain. And we'll go a little bit more in depth in some of that, but generally, you get most of the energy out of the electron transport chain in the sense of ATP, right? There's some GTPs in there, but the main point is you get majority of ATP from electron transport chain. Where is it that you need oxygen? Is it in glycolysis or the TCA cycle, electron transport chain? Electron transport chain. So we're all on the same page. All right, great. All right, so let's cruise through some of this. So glycolysis, you get the NADH. Do you remember you get an NADH in glycolysis? And then that is used in the electron transport chain. So you are making some molecules that are later transported into the mitochondria and then used for energy. But you get some ATP out of glycolysis. Trick question that we've seen on some standardized exams, and it confuses people. Just something to remember. How many ATP total do you make in glycolysis? Anybody have biochemistry yet? Do you remember like the total number of ATP in glycolysis? 4. But the net ATP is 2. And this tricks people on standardized exams. They might come back and say, "What? I thought it was 2, but I saw this 4. So the difference is you make 4 ATP in glycolysis, but within the cycle, and I don't want you to have to memorize where, but you actually have to use 2 ATP within that cycle. So your net gain of ATP in glycolysis is only 2 ATP. But if you look at the total, let's go back here. Generally, around 32 when you break down one glucose molecule. But if you're only making net 2, look how many more you make, 30 more or so, by going through the TCA electron transport chain. So it's much more efficient to go through the TCA electron transport chain than just staying in glycolysis. You're not making as much ATP. All right? So it's much more efficient to utilize the oxygen and utilize the mitochondria. That's the take. Don't try to memorize all of the details in there, but these main points is what I'm wanting you to know. And you don't have to memorize 32, 34, 36. It depends on the textbook you read. And generally, it's around 32 to 38 ATP that you make by a complete breakdown of glucose, okay? Because it's the way that you might count utilizing that NADH that I just mentioned to you, the NADH that comes out of glycolysis, to go into the mitochondria, that actually takes some energy. So this is why the numbers don't completely match up when you're just counting NADH. Maybe in biochemistry, did you cover that kind of in-depth? Somebody that had biochemistry? No? Yes? Maybe? Yes? Okay, good. All right. So the main points are those. Okay, we'll go through that. So we already said about efficiency. And That pyruvate converted to acetyl-CoA, and one of the byproducts is CO2 that you make from that process in glycolysis. And then when you get into the electron, the TCA, electron transport chain, you actually make more CO2, right? Where does that CO2 go as a byproduct? Remember, it's a gas. It's made in your cells. You go across the cell membrane into your bloodstream, and then we'll talk about how that's converted to bicarbonate. That bicarbonate is transported in your blood up to your lungs, and then it's converted back to CO2, and then you blow it out to the atmosphere. Okay, so that's the CO2. And we'll talk a little bit more about that as we go along. Okay, so it's called a cycle because it basically keeps going around, and it's called the citric acid cycle for one thing, because you start with citrate up there. But you get the idea. So the take-home points are, here in this cycle, you're making not a lot of ATP in this cycle, but you make a GDP or GTP that can be converted to ATP, so you make some ATP. These NADHs go on into the mitochondria, and then that's where you go through electron transport chain, I mean into the Christie of electron transport chain, and then you make ATP out of these. But the point here is the CO2s. So Hans Krebs was really fantastic. What he did is he actually labeled these carbons that come in like in a glucose, and he can actually tell you what part of that glucose molecule that CO2 came from. And so I don't know, did you have to do that in biochemistry class? Anybody like know which carbon on a glucose made that CO2? No? Good, they don't torture you anymore doing those things. Alright. So that's basically the take on one of these cycles, just that you get an idea. And we put in some different figures from different textbooks so you can get kind of familiar with it. Oh, they call it the Ferris wheel as well. Okay, electron transport chain is where you transfer those electrons onto the final electron acceptor, which is oxygen. So you want to remember, oxygen accepts that electron, and that's where you need that oxygen molecule. And the byproduct of that is, what did we talk about, that Dr. Kangaroo Rat? Remember that tangent mentioned before, right? Water. This is called metabolic water, because it's from metabolism. So that's what you want to remember from this. So you're making water. Okay. And I don't want you to have to memorize all the parts of the electron transport chain, but just again, to kind of show you what's going on, you have these different complexes in the electron transport chain, and every one of them can help in with this process. What they're doing is actually pushing this hydrogen up into the space between the inner mitochondrial membrane and that space of the outer side of the mitochondria. So this inner mitochondrial space builds up with a high hydrogen content. What happens there, you have a gradient now. You have a gradient of hydrogen in that space. And now when it comes through this ATP synthase, this enzyme, it can actually then, if you've seen some of these pictures, maybe you showed you in cell, it's really cool. It rotates around and the hydrogen comes through and then it can make ATP. So it's really neat. And what it does is it adds phosphate back to ADP and you get ATP, right? So it's really neat. You might see some videos online that actually show that. The point here, too, is that it's, again, a concentration gradient. And you needed to actually use this NADH just to help with that concentration gradient, but you can get ATP out of it as a net result. Okay, so that's the main thing to think about. And if you hear of particular drugs that might block the electron transport chain, there are different medications that can actually block these different complexes, and they can actually then stop the synthesis of ATP. So you might hear of a particular cascade or complex that a drug works at, so you just have a kind of a mindset where this takes place. Okay, so if you want a good tattoo, you could write C6H12O6, right? And then 6 oxygen molecules making 6 CO2s and 6 waters, ATP plus heat if you want to. So that CO2, what happens with that CO2? As we talked about, it blows off, right? And the electron transport chain makes about 30 ATPs, right? So that's where you're getting the majority of your ATP produced. All right, so that's good. So I don't want you to have to, you know, go crazy trying to memorize everything. And of course, then that energy is used for lots of things. We mentioned it before about heat production, but also then for all those processes that go on in the cell. Right? Okay. If you think about it, if you didn't have oxygen, or if you're exercising and you can't get enough oxygen, right, to be able to use that oxygen for electron transport chain, what happens as you're breaking down glucose? Well, you're going to produce lactate, one of the products of glycolysis. So let's just look at this here in this cascade. It's a little easier to think about. So glucose to pyruvate to lactate, but if you have oxygen and your mitochondria can function, then you can pull that pyruvate in and then use the TCA electron transport chain and get more ATP out of it, right? This is the idea of lactic acid building up, right, from exercise. You might have heard of people, you know, hitting the wall, basically. They're exercising or they're running a marathon and then all of a sudden they can't move anymore. And they've used up their energy stores, and this is when they really have depleted their glucose levels and glycogen levels, and then they really just can't function anymore. So that's really something interesting, too. Let's go to this next little spot. Okay, so here's a little exercise for us to try to remember. We need a victim. Probably seen these little PO2 saturation of oxygen monitors, you know, in the hospital and stuff they put on your finger, right? So he's going to put this on his finger, and it says it's called SPO2, so percent saturation. So if you're ever seeing in the hospital, you know, they'll have that on the finger. It's usually hooked up to a little device, and it's running right now, and maybe you can tell us what it reads there.
98.
So now he's going to take a deep breath, and he's going to hold it and not breathe. And we're going to see how long it takes for him to hold his breath and then what this reads at the end. So right now it's at 98. Let's see what his heart rate is. I think it'll read his heart rate as 54. It'll probably go up as he starts to have to breathe, right? So right now, is he still at 98? You can tell us.
Yeah.
Yeah, still at 98. Is he beginning to have to breathe over through your nose or your ears?
His heart rate's starting to go up.
Is it? All right, he's getting stressed. And if he's a swimmer, he could probably hold it for another.
Now it's at 99.
It's at 99, it's going up. Ooh, how's it going up?
But his heart rate's at 62.
His heart's at 62, okay. So, can you have to breathe? Go on the swim team if you can hold it for 3 minutes.
His heart rate's still going up, it's at 66 now.
66, heart rate's up.
All right.
And think about this. This is really kind of an interesting little device. It's on your finger, and it's measuring the percent oxygen saturation. Some people make a mistake with this, but in clinic. Well, okay, had to breathe. What's the value?
Still at 98.
Still at 98. What's going on here? So, you had to breathe, and it still stayed at 98. So, did your oxygen drop? Your saturation of oxygen? No. But you had to breathe. Right? So, this is somewhat of a misconception. So, you've probably heard it in high school, or maybe in a freshman biology class, you know, you exercise. And if you ran in here, you're late class, you can't be late, and you ran in here and you sat down, your breathing rate is still pretty high, right? And why is that? What's the general concept that you hear of why your breathing rate is higher? Oxygen. What do we usually see in textbooks? Oxygen debt. Was it an oxygen debt? Still 98. Why was it that you had to breathe at a faster? Are you really driving to breathe? Was it really the low oxygen?
To get rid of carbon dioxide.
To get rid of carbon dioxide. Now, are you really monitoring carbon dioxide in your body? Or are you measuring the problem with carbon dioxide that is in the water, in your blood, in your body, in your plasma, in your blood? So what happens if we took plain fresh water, maybe we should do this as an exercise, and you bubbled CO2 in that water, what would happen to the pH?
I was going to say it changes the pH. So that's why
which way does it change pH?
More acidic.
More acidic, right? So it becomes more acidic. And if you took fresh water and did that, and even if you blew, we should do that as an exercise, blow bubbles into fresh water, the pH of the solution will drop. It'll become more acidic. That acidity is what drives you to have wanting to breathe, basically. And that acidity is what's driving you to breathe after you've exercised and sit down. You're actually compensating to try to get your CO2 blown off so you can bring your pH back up to a normal range. So it's not an oxygen debt. It's a pH imbalance that causes you to increase your breathing rate after exercise. So it's not the oxygen debt. It's the pH, right? So try to get that misconception out of your mind, which is taught over and over again in high school and maybe even in freshman biology. I'm not sure. Okay. So a good example on this, and we'll be covering a little bit of this later in respiration, but I want to bring it up here that we've covered cell metabolism. So you understand that at the cell level, you know, from that drive that he has, that means that CO2 is rising enough in his oxygen. He didn't have enough oxygen stores to really, you know, control his breathing for 10 minutes or so, right? That means he's using that up, and that CO2 is rising, that pH is dropping in that short period of time, right? So if he was to exercise, being running in place, would he be able to hold his breath longer or less time? Probably less time, right? Because he's actually using up more oxygen and more metabolism and producing more CO2, and the pH is dropping even faster. So you get the idea? All right. So now, what happens, and this is a clinical type of aspect as well, what happens to a person that has COPD? What's COPD? Anybody know COPD? Chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or disorder, right? So what does this do? From mostly, Kentucky ranks like number one. We rank number one here. West Virginia's right up there too. From smoking. All right. Mostly from smoking. So we have it's cost a lot for the taxpayers in Kentucky and your health insurance as well. So what happens to somebody that has chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder? They can't breathe well. They can't get good oxygen exchange. They can't get good CO2 exchange. So they have this chronic. Chronic means chronic, right? Long term. So what happens to them? They are actually functioning at a lower pH because they're not getting out the CO2 very well. So if they're functioning at a lower pH, right, then what happens? You've seen older people carrying their oxygen tank behind them, right? They're carrying their oxygen tank. And they're out of oxygen. So they walk across the room, they're out of oxygen, and then they sit down and they're breathing faster. So what are they going to do? What would you do? And if you're a family member, what might you do for grandma? Would you maybe, if you're still out of breath, can't be breathing. So what do they do? Turn up the oxygen. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? How many think it's a good thing? Turn up oxygen. Because you know that I'm tricking you already, right? How many think it's a bad thing? How many don't care? No. So what happens if you're chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, you usually function at a lower pH, right? And you can handle a lower oxygen. The oxygen saturation will probably be lower as well. So what happens to grandma, she'll actually turn up her oxygen, right? And because thinking, I need more oxygen. But if you're in chronic obstructive pulmonary disorder, it's not so much the pH that drives you anymore, it's the hypoxia that drives you. Hypoxia means low oxygen. Hypoxia, low oxygen. So because you kind of desensitize these receptors, and they don't know exactly how this works, and it's really quite interesting. There's a guy that up at Wright State Medical School in Dayton, Ohio, that's actually one of the world's experts on this function. And they're actually working with comparative physiology to actually address this chronic exposure to low pH and higher CO2, and how the neurons change their receptivity. But basically, you're driven by hypoxia in this situation. So if you're driven by low oxygen, and now grandma turns up her oxygen, so now she gets more oxygen, do you increase your breathing rate or would you decrease your breathing rate? If breathing is driven by hypoxia, you decrease it, right? If you decrease your breathing rate, what happens to the CO2 in your body? It's going to be building up. And what happens to your pH? It's dropping. So did you make it worse or better for this person? Made it worse, right? So this is the problem. And oxygen is actually a prescription on the floor in the hospital and other places because it's actually a drug. And if you are working on the floor, if you're CNAs or working on the floor, they might be a standing order for the floor, but they're set at a certain rate for a certain reason. You start playing with it. Family members always like to play with stuff like that. You can actually do more harm than good. So there's a paper published 2 years ago by Emergency Medical Services, Emergency Medical Journal, actually showing that EMS workers were doing more harm than good by taking a patient and throwing the oxygen mask on them right away while we take them to the ER. Because they would get to the ER and then do the blood gas analysis and actually find that their pH is way lower than it should be and their CO2 is higher. And they were actually doing more harm to patients than good by putting an oxygen mask on them right away. So now, because you don't know if they have COPD or not. So you don't want to cause more harm than good, right? So they have to be very careful with this. Now they're making new types of respiratory masks to actually measure the CO2 that comes out. But right now they don't have those out for all the EMS workers. They do in some places. So that's going to be kind of a change in practice. It's really neat. But now you know the physiology behind it, right? What's really quite interesting is if you look at lower vertebrates like fish, they're usually not pH driven. They're hypoxic driven. Isn't that kind of interesting? So it's more in the higher mammals that you start to see CO2 pH driven compared to hypoxia driven. Now you have, as a redundant mechanism, when you desensitize your pH sensitivity, you actually then have hypoxic sensitivity in your aortic arch and in your carotid bodies. Right? So how to remember something for your standardized test, for example, that you might be taking, and this is a people get confused on this. How do you measure your pH in your body versus blood pressure? So try to remember this, and we're going to cover it again. Blood pressure, when you have a sinus headache, what does it feel like? It's got pressure in your sinuses, right? So carotid sinuses are for blood pressure. And you can think of sinuses like a sinus headache, right? Pressure. Carotid bodies are for your pH sensitivity. Now I say CO2 pH, but it's really pH sensitivity. All right. And we'll come back to that a little bit later. So that tangent of the exercise with the saturation of oxygen, hopefully you see where we're going with that and how all that leads. Now a little bit of a kind of an awareness situation. This is measuring percent saturation of your hemoglobin that's going through your finger. In gals that are wearing fingernail polish, it doesn't work well sometimes, so it gets an inaccurate measure. They might put it on an earlobe, might see something like that, or even on a toe, for example, in a clinic situation. But what's the problem with this? And you hear even physicians sometimes saying the wrong thing. If you are anemic, the saturation of oxygen is perfectly fine. It's at 98, but their lips are turning blue. But the saturation's normal. It's 98. It can't be have low oxygen, right? It's 98. It's reading the values. What's the problem with this? It's at 98, 96, and the person's turning blue. They don't have good oxygenation. Where's the problem? Anybody? CNAs? Something? Work in the clinics? Volunteer? Shadow? Not enough red blood cells. So you can be anemic, low RBCs, right? But your saturation of those low RBCs would be the same. Get the point? So you could be bleeding out internally, red blood cells are down, but your saturation stays the same. This is where this can be a problem in relying on this if you don't understand what they're actually measuring. Okay, so I wanted you to kind of get that points across as we go through. So again, ATP, right? Triphosphate, and you can actually take off that phosphate when you get ADP, adenosine diphosphate. You can actually take off that other phosphate and you'll have AMP, adenosine monophosphate. So you can get multiple ATPs off. It just takes more energy, or you're not getting as much out of it if you break the second phosphate or the next one down. So it's usually ATP to ADP in that process. So you get the idea. And you know, you get some kilocalories per mole from that energy product, and it wants to break down. It's favored for breaking down, right? But you also get, I don't want you to just think ATP is the only energy molecule in your body. In your muscles, for example, you store phosphate and creatinine, and you can get the phosphate off of the creatinine. You might hear health food stores actually selling you phosphate creatinine so you can eat it and actually build up stores in your body, and there's some truth behind that. And you have to watch out these diet stores and health food stores that do some crazy things. But you get energy out of other storage molecules that can donate phosphate. Just that we always cover ATP generally. But you do store in your body phosphocreatinine. And some animals, like some birds, migratory birds, store this as a very large energy source for them. All right, we'll talk more about that when we later in the course. Actually, you'll see that we come back to this chapter over and over again, even at the very end of the class when we're talking about heat and energy metabolism. Okay? So the general idea, you know, you might have seen your textbooks, 36, 38. Just want you to see this again, the general idea, CO2, water, metabolic water, oxygen. Here's something that we want to remember. It's not just carbohydrates, glucose, which you always hear about when you're going through these energy processes, right? We can get energy from what? We can get energy from fats, sugars, and proteins, right? So fats, you can break down fats, lipids, through a fatty acid cycle, which we'll talk a little bit about, and those can enter, bypass glycolysis, and enter into the TCA cycle, okay? So you get energy from fat by breaking it down, and you can get energy from proteins, too. You break down proteins. What are proteins made out of?
Amino acids.
Those amino acids can enter at different points in the TCA cycle. And then so you're going to get a different amount of energy depending on what amino acid is entering the TCA cycle, okay? So the take-home here is you can get energy, ATP production from fats, carbohydrates, and proteins. And you'll start breaking down your proteins when you use up your glycogen stores, and your fat stores, and then you start to break down muscle mass, right? And your muscle is the largest mass in your body for your weight, right? So that's pretty neat. Okay. So how is all this regulated? Do you want to make a whole bunch of ATP right now? Just make a whole bunch right now? You don't want to do that, right? You want to use it as you need it, right? While you're exercising and breaking down those storage molecules. So how is it regulated? That's the key point as well. And it's regulated by these feedback mechanisms, just like we talked about with temperature, pH, salinity, negative feedback processes. So look at this. This is pretty cool. This is your TCA cycle. And that first step, that enzyme, which I don't want you to memorize, I want you to get the main point here, that enzyme is actually inhibited by ATP. Isn't that wild? So if you make a whole bunch of ATP, that ATP is loose in this mitochondria, it can actually go back and inhibit the enzymes not to make more ATP. So it's a negative feedback process. And then as ATP is used and it drops down, then it's removed in the inhibition, and then you go ahead and make more. Look at this. Inhibited by succinyl CoA, that's what's coming in here, and NADH. So if you have a lot of NADH, you're actually inhibiting this enzyme. That's pretty neat, too. Different ways to regulate your ATP production so you don't make more than what you need, right? You need it as you're utilizing it. So some pretty neat processes. Look at this here. This is really cool, too. Stimulated by ADP. So adenosine diphosphate, as you use the ATP up and you have ADP, you're actually stimulating this enzyme and you're stimulating these enzymes up here. So to make ATP, the take home here is that it's finely tuned for your energy demand at the cellular level, at the mitochondrial level. But think about what we just talked about. The cell level using up energy makes CO2, goes into your blood, and what does it do? Makes you increase your respiration, increase diaphragm respiration, so it's driving your whole body. The cells, what's going on in the cells, is driving your whole body's function. So this is why cell level is so important to understand in the physiological concepts, okay? So at the cell, I mean, that's pretty amazing to think about, those little cells, right, doing things. So the same idea is kind of neat, too. If you look at the electron transport chain, we talked a little bit about this, but I don't want you to memorize this. There's things that can block the electron transport chain. I don't want you to memorize where, but I want you to understand that you can block the electron transport chain by a few key aspects. One I told you about last time we met, right? Azymes that are in the mold inhibiting, like in your pH electrode solutions that you buffer with. We talked about that. That's an azide. It's N3. Also, carbon monoxide, so CO, right? You hear about people, and I don't mean to joke with it, but it's sad, where somebody might take the exhaust out of their car, put it under the window, you know, hair carry, whatever, right? That CO, carbon monoxide, why does that kill you? Well, it blocks the electron transport chain. That's one aspect. If you can't make ATP, you can't be utilizing your muscles to breathe, right, your diaphragm. But also, what is another key aspect of carbon monoxide what kills you from this?
It binds to hemoglobin.
It binds to hemoglobin around 200 or 210 times stronger than oxygen. So if it binds the hemoglobin stronger at the same spot where oxygen's binding and displaces the oxygen, but it's 200 times stronger, you're not going to get the oxygen there, but also you're inhibiting your enzymes to make it ATP, so you're really in a bad situation. And carbon monoxide, you don't smell it, right? So you might not know it's there. That's why they have those carbon monoxide detectors in homes. That's why it's so important, because you can really pass out quite quickly with carbon monoxide poisoning. And this is why you've died from that. Some drugs actually block these enzymatic pathways as well. So antibiotics at too high a levels, what could they do? Toxic effects, right? That's why the therapeutic window is really important for antibiotics. Because bacteria will also use these same steps, right? Bacteria have mitochondria in them, right? How some of these antibiotics work is actually blocking the enzymatic pathways in the bacteria in their mitochondria. But their mitochondria is really no different than your mitochondria. So if you go up too high, what's going to happen? You start to inhibit yours. So there are macrolids where a whole group of antibiotics, like vancomycin, mycines are antibiotics, and they were used clinically in people. But they found out it caused too many side effects and actually killed some people from it, and so they took it off the market. But how does it work? It's kind of interesting. If we go back to that crazy figure I had way back where, here, it actually blocks these hydrogen pumps. And in bacteria, if it blocks those hydrogen pumps in bacteria, in the mitochondria, what does it do to your mitochondria? It does the same thing, right? But not only that, to make transmitter into your vesicles in your nervous system, transmitters released in packets, it's in these little vesicles that fuse to the membrane and then release the transmitter. We'll go through that, but how to get transmitter into those little packets, it actually requires a hydrogen pump to make it very acidic inside those little vesicles inside your nerve terminals. So then it starts a concentration gradient, so hydrogen can go out and a transmitter can come in. So you package your glutamate transmitters this way, you package your GABA transmitters this way, your acetylcholine transmitters this way, in your nervous system. But if you block that hydrogen pump, what happens to the transmitter level in your nervous system? It's way down, right? So that was what this antibiotic did, and it actually caused people neurologically to be depressed, and it killed some people from this too, but it also then hit the mitochondria and throughout your whole body, and that was a problem too. So understanding how antibiotics work at a mechanistic level is important, so then you would understand how they could actually inhibit your function and why it's so critical to be careful where they are, right, and the levels, and not just evolve them down all at once. You know, more is better, right? So you take a whole pile of pills at one time for antibiotics. Okay, so we kind of get through that, and you understand then some of these processes here, so that's really good. This is, I don't want you to memorize this, but I just want you to hear about it because it's important to understand that you can break down fat through a fatty acid cycle, so lipids. I need to break down a few more, but and they go to acetyl-CoA, and that acetyl-CoA goes into your TCA cycle, and you get energy from it, right? And the same thing with proteins can be broken down to amino acids, as we talked about. So what happens in your exercise in skeletal muscle? You're exercising, you're using up ATP. Let's say you can't utilize it fast enough, your pyruvate, right? And it then gets converted to lactate, lactic acid, you've probably heard about that. That builds up in your muscle, goes out of the muscle, goes in your bloodstream. What's really interesting is that your liver can take that lactate, convert it back to glucose, and that's called gluconeogenesis. Glucose, neo, genesis, production, right? So gluconeogenesis, it can be converted back to glucose, and then back into the blood, and then back where you need it, right? So that's kind of neat. And that's the process of not just building up lactate. And you might have heard of, you know, when you exercise and you're sore, right, your muscles are sore, people say, what, it's due to lactic acid. Well, they found out it's not really so much a lactic acid. It really has to do with calcium leaking in your muscles. And that supposedly causes the soreness, really. So it's kind of interesting. You can get calcium channel blockers, and you actually then don't have that soreness after exercising so much. So it's an interesting process, and still not completely understood. So let's look at storage molecules. So you've probably heard of a good storage molecule for building up. If you're going to run the marathon the next day, What would you eat?
Carbs.
Carbs, right. You're not going to eat a high protein diet. You're really going to eat carbs. So what do those carbs do? You don't need them right away. So what are you going to do with those?
Storage them.
Yeah, and you're not going to just storage them as glucose. You're going to convert it to glycogen. And that glycogen molecule is really a good storage molecule of glucose. Why is it so good is that it itself doesn't require a lot of water around it for storage. So migratory birds, for example, will store a lot of glycogen. You might have seen some shows on PBS or Nature Show where they have actually taken mussel samples from like the Arctic tern. That's a bird that can go all the way up in Alaska and go all the way down to South America. And it, you know, a really big migratory pathway. And they can sample the mussel as these birds, you know, go across. And they actually see that they have to build up their glycogen stores. So, you know, every little kind of stop, and there's a big place like in Nebraska where they migrate to, and then they build up reserves and they store up the glycogen again, and then they fly down to Mexico, and then they store it again, and then they fly again. And they keep seeing these where they need to land as they use up their glycogen stores. You have glycogen in your muscles too. And it's really quite neat because then you can break down those are individual glucose molecules that are bound together to make the storage molecule glycogen. We don't have to try to memorize these different bonds that are in there, but how important do you think glycogen is as a storage molecule? Pretty important, right? And this is the point I wanted to mention, is there's a number of diseases. This is a very old table, but some of these, and there's more things to it, but generally, these are really important. These are the enzymatic pathways, the breakdowns that we were just talking about here, like the alpha-1-6 or this alpha-1-4 linkage, to break it down to get glucose. Look how important this is. Cardiorespiratory failure causes death by age of 2. That's this Pompe's disease. This one here, death usually by the age by 2. This is that alpha-4, alpha-1-6. So if you don't have that enzyme, if there's a defect in that enzyme, you can't break down glycogen. You're not going to live very long. Usually they die from it. They're trying gene therapy to correct these kind of things, but they haven't perfected this yet. So it's pretty neat to think about how important glycogen is and how important it is to break it down. You won't live very long with it. Okay, so I know that's gross, but anyways, it's something to think about how important it is. Now, here comes, everything's not black and white, right? You memorize all these things. It's kind of like we said 3-2 for sodium potassium. And we talk about, you know, how many ATP with like glucose breakdown, but it's the range, right? Same with the range with that. Same with everything we just talked about with glycolysis and TCA cycle. There are some animals that can use the enzymes, and don't get confused on a standardized test because this won't be on there. This is kind of like that exceptional stuff. Some animals, particularly these Pelamenthi worms, parasites, right? They can actually utilize the steps in glycolysis anaerobically. It means no oxygen needed. So if these animals have found other ways to use those steps in glycolysis without oxygen, in the TCA cycle without oxygen needed. So in the TCA cycle, they can use some of those pathways without oxygen. So anaerobically, in the TCA cycle, we always put that into a aerobic, you know, classification, aerobic with oxygen. So it's kind of interesting. Different. There's a whole journal out that comes out every month on comparative endocrinology, comparative biochemistry, and they actually look at these odd animals to try to see how they utilize energy metabolism. And this is kind of one of those neat steps. So you can see the redundancy and the way of surviving for these animals, utilizing those cascades without oxygen. All right. So we've talked about aerobic and anaerobic animals. Some bacteria can live anaerobically without oxygen, and others then need oxygen to live. If you take microbiology, anybody taking micro, right? You've probably talked about anaerobic and aerobic bacteria, and then how those can actually have problems with you as well. So at the end of the semester, when you're cleaning out your dorm room, and you have that old can of instant spaghetti or something, right? Or a can of soup, Campbell's soup. And you think, well, I just finished moving everything. I need to get some energy. I'm going to pop open that last can of tomato soup or whatever and eat it before I go home. And you open it up and you hear that gas pop out. Would you be eating that, do you think? Would that be good to eat? because it's probably developed a lot of gas anaerobically of some bacteria that was in there, and then you're going to end up in the ER, you know, after you, you know, eat that stuff. So not good. All right. You can see this bacteria, Clostridium, you know, toxin can actually be made in that too. It's not good. All right. So just the idea: about 20 times more efficient if you use your mitochondria than if you just use glycolysis. So something to kind of remember, a general idea. And botulinum. Why is botulinum so bad? Botulinum good, bad? It's not good. Right? Anybody know how botulinum can kill you?
I could be wrong, but doesn't it paralyze like your gastric organs?
Gastric organs? Yes. Hold that thought. Yeah, hands back there.
Yeah, it
inhibits
the release of CFOA, something like that.
Yeah, probably you're thinking about. Acetylcholine,
yeah.
Right, which is your neurotransmitter at your neuromuscular junction for your respiratory, your muscles, your legs, acetylcholine. What botulinum is doing is actually, and we'll get to this, we'll talk about it again, but while we're talking about those vesicles inside your nerve terminals, those little vesicles that fuse to the membrane, the release transmitter, those vesicles have proteins that hold it to the presynaptic membrane. So when calcium comes in, the vesicle fuses and releases transmitter. Those proteins that are holding it right there are susceptible to the botulinum toxin. They cleave those proteins so the vesicle can't fuse. So it's just sitting up here. The calcium might come in the nerve terminal, but the vesicle can't fuse. The botulinums go from something like A to H. They're classified A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And they all work on different parts of how those proteins hold the vesicles to the presynaptic membrane. Now, you might have heard of people getting botulinum injections. Why do they do that? Paralyze, but what are they trying to paralyze?
Facial muscles.
Why would you want to paralyze facial muscles?
Less
to get rid of wrinkles. Isn't that horrible? We're so vain. Yes.
Haven't they tried to use it on Parkinson's patients to calm nerves?
And they actually use it with people with migraines, too, very severe migraines that can't be treated by other wells. They'll actually inject botulinum toxin to keep the blood vessels from being spastic and stuff. Sorry. And in their brain. So it's kind of neat. They use it for different things. But you hear of models that don't want wrinkles, or somebody that's really vain, they don't want wrinkles, the crow's feet, right, on their face. And so they inject botulinum toxin because what does it do? It blocks acetylcholine release. It blocks that nerve terminal, and that's why you have crow's feet, because your motor nerve's firing and it's making those little muscles wrinkle right there, or forehead, your, you know how you wrinkle your forehead, right? All that is by nerves acting on those muscles. So if you don't want those, you can actually inject botulinum in there and it blocks the nerve from releasing transmitter. Now what's the problem with this? So this model, there was a really wild case in England. She got these injections of botulinum and she was like a drama, you know, thing or whatever, Days of Our Lives or whatever that thing's called. And she couldn't have any more facial expressions. And how important is facial expressions? If you're trying to convey, like, oh, I'm so sad, or something like that, right? So she couldn't have any facial expressions, so they took her off the roll, and then she sued back the doc because the doc didn't tell her that she was going to lose all facial expressions, and it turned into a big mess, right? But also they use it clinically, really important aspects, like I mentioned with migraines, but also some people have plethorospasms, where their eye just keeps blinking all the time and they can't control it, so they can inject the eye muscles up here to keep it from being spastic. And that's another thing. And some people have laryngeal spasms, which is really important too, where they can't, you know, swallow or they can't talk right. So they'll actually inject the laryngeal muscles with this and actually then localize it right there to keep it so they don't have spasms in their larynx. There was a case a number of years back, it was connected with UK, it was actually in our ophthalmology department. This guy that was up there, and he was working with a group in Florida, and they actually had to go and investigate this guy as well. But what was happening in Florida, there was a physician down in Florida, and botulinum toxin, that's really expensive if it's clinically used, because they check it for its safety and its therapeutic window on animals, so it is expensive, and they do test it on animals so they can get the right units. Whereas this physician in Florida didn't want to pay out all that money, but he could just charge his patients a whole lot of money. So he bought it from a third source over the border, and he bought illegal botulinum, but it still was botulinum, injected it in a husband and wife. They both died from it. because they gave too high of a level of the botulinum injections for them to get rid of their wrinkles, basically. So you could die from getting too much of that stuff. The same as if you ate a can that's growing too much of it in your soup at the end of the semester, right? So throw it away. Don't save it. It's not worth it.
So I know that like some people will continuously get like Botox. So does it deplete their nature? Like, what is?
That's a good question. So the question was, people keep getting these injections all the time because they don't want the crow's feet coming back. So what happens if you block that vesicle by cleaving those proteins that holds it to the presynaptic nerve terminal?
Yep,
right. The vesicle can't fuse, right? What makes the nerves grow to the muscle? What makes nerves grow to the muscle? In development. Let's just think about this. I know, tangents are good because we learned so much about it. And then we don't have to cover it later on because we're going to cover it later on anyways. So let's say we... Synaptic strength, exactly. So let's say we have a muscle here, right? And we have a nerve that's growing to that muscle. How much innervation should that nerve have on that muscle? And this gentleman hit it right on the point. There is a feedback mechanism with every neuron in your brain, but also at your neuromuscular junctions. So as you develop, your muscles are really small, right? And the nerve's growing to that. And it can allow the little baby to contract their arms. But think of that little baby. It grows, right? Legs grow. Arms grow. Now, the muscle's a lot bigger. So how much synaptic transmission are you going to give to that large muscle now, right? Or to your neurons that are growing in your brain, right? So there's this feedback mechanism. It doesn't matter if it's a nerve or a muscle. There's this feedback mechanism back from the target that feeds back and communicates to the nerve and says, I'm not getting enough transmission. Jack it up a little bit. So it can actually branch and make more synapses, more connections. It can actually make the synapses it has more efficient and makes more vesicles to fuse. Okay, so now we did the botulinum injection and we knocked these out or reduced their function. What's the target cell going to say? I'm not getting enough. Up, ramp it up, right? So the nerve can actually branch and make new connections. So now what do you have to do? The crow's feet are coming back. Oh no. Inject it again, right? Inject it again.
I think they also use it for like excessive perspiration.
Yes.
How does that
work? So you're so the question was here, they use it also for excessive perspiration, sweating. So some people sweat a lot. If you're in an interview, maybe this is something you want to do. But those sweat glands are controlled by muscle, contracted. So if you can block the nerves that innervate those muscles, they can't contract, so you don't sweat as much. So you won't have as much sweat production. So they use this for many different things, but you know, I wouldn't go home and start injecting botulinum that you bought over the border, right? So not a good idea. And this is why it's regulated, and you might have to keep getting these injections. But when do you actually stop? You know, there's a limit to all this, right? And what are you doing to, if it gets away from that localized site, what's it doing to other spots in your body, right? Just like when you eat botulinum in your food that's poisoned, it's going throughout your body. That's why it kills you, right? So the localized injection is highest there, but it might be spreading around. So not a great thing to do, right? So, you know, just kind of...
So that's like what my mom says, like, don't eat that or you'll get botulinum.
Same.
Okay.
This is it. All right. Okay, so let's look at this, for example. This is your wonderful preparation. This is your crayfish preparation. This is on one of the muscles that allows the animal and your crayfish, next time you hold it, its leg's going out like that or it's trying to pinch you. We glue them closed for you so you don't get pinched when you're handling them later. Did you get to handle the crayfish yet? Oh, shame. They're such cute little things, big black eyes. And but we glue their claws closed so they won't pinch you and you won't be yelling and throwing them up in the air when they pinch you and things like that. But if you look at their muscles that are for extending the arm out, you can actually stain up the nerves that innervate that muscle. And this is a stain that stains the mitochondria. This is a living nerve. And a nerve has multiple neurons. A neuron is a single cell. A nerve can be made up of many cells, many neurons. So here we have two axons. This axon here, and then the axon at the top. And this is a stain for a mitochondria. the more bright, the more white this is, the more mitochondria. So which nerve has more mitochondria? The top or the bottom? Bottom, everybody agree? Okay, so on par or something. Good. So the bottom one has more mitochondria. So what might you think the function of that nerve is compared to the other nerve? Any ideas?
Requires more energy
because it has more mitochondria, right? And that's exactly it. If we looked at a cross section through there, you would see something like this. I know it's a little hard to see in the back, possibly, but the top one here has those mitochondria, those little, see if I can get this laser to work, these little things right here, this is a cross section in electron microscopy, these are all mitochondria. And in this other nerve, you see just a few mitochondria around the border, right? So when you stain it, you got very few of them. The T and the T give this away a little bit. The one nerve is tonically firing for posture, just like your neck muscles, right? Posture, unless you're like, I'm really boring here. Can't keep awake. And the other one is a phasic nerve terminal that just fires intermittently, like when the animal wants to really move its arm out really quickly, right, to grab you. So what's really interesting about these animals, they have two types of neurons, a phasic and a tonic, innervating even the same muscle. You have tonic and phasic motor neurons and muscles, but the tonic nerve only innervates tonic muscle, and the phasic nerve only innervates phasic muscle or fast muscle. These animals can actually have a single muscle fiber innervated by both types of nerve terminals, which is really interesting. We'll talk more about that later. Yes? Pardon? Oh, they haven't developed the strength yet. Their muscles haven't really developed up yet for that strength. That's why you want to hold their head. But then they can develop pretty quickly. But the heads are so big on those old infants, right, that they do become weak. But if they continue that and they're weak, what they call that floppy baby syndrome, and that can be problems of lots of disorders that we'll talk about more when we get to skeletal muscle. All right? So there are disorders when the baby doesn't get enough rigidity, and that is a big problem. Okay, so this is kind of neat. And if you actually look at the mitochondria with a particular type of imaging called Marmarsky imaging, look at this. This is actually a mitochondria. Look how long it is. So in your textbooks, you always see these little, you know, oval-looking things like football, but that's not the case in many cells. They don't look like that. They can actually, this mitochondria, this nerve terminal, can be very long, millimeters long, and actually branch. So it's pretty neat. And it can actually move in the axon back and around and down to the terminal and back up. So it's a very dynamic process. So just to get some ideas about these, it's really quite neat. All right, so I think I quit yapping. Oh, just for people studying for MCAT things, I put these few little slides in there. Some of these are gee whizzy, or you might have covered it in already biochemistry, but I just want to hit it now because we won't come back to it. Remember what enzymes do? What do? Lower that activation energy and make things go forward, right? It's like CO2 plus water can make bicarbonate, right? Plus a hydrogen ion. And that's another tattoo that you could get, right? But with carbonic anhydrase, the enzyme, it speeds it up a millionfold sped up. You have carbonic anhydrase in you. As far as I know, every animal has carbonic anhydrase in different isoforms. But it speeds up that reaction by making it favorable. And what do we usually refer to? Reduces the activation energy. So that's the idea. You see that in standardized exams. Just want to make sure, in case you didn't have biochemistry, this started. So reducing that activation energy with an enzyme can favor that reaction. All right. Some things about proteins, just to kind of remember. Remember, two amino acids together, you have a linear. What is that called for protein structure?
Primary.
Right. So also enzymes, like break down amino acids, right? Break down the peptide to two different amino acids, or start breaking them apart. Enzymes. What's critical about enzymes? They function at particular what? pHs. Temperature and salinity, right? And an enzyme has an optimal range to work in. So some enzymes in your stomach where the pH is 1 or 2, they'll work really well there. But as soon as it becomes basic, they won't work. So if you take a bunch of Tums and then eat a meal, what's going to happen? You're probably not breaking down that meal very well. right? So things to think about. You want to keep that environment to make those enzymes work functionally. As that food leaves your stomach and goes into your small intestines, the duodenum, and then right in your small intestine, you secrete a lot of basic solutions. And those basic solutions go in there to raise the pH. Well, now, the enzymes that were working in your stomach that enter that region aren't working, but a different set of enzymes now work in a basic environment. So if you're not able to make that environment basic, then those acidic enzymes come in, and they're going to be working, and that might not be so good for some of the cell membranes that are inside of that region there. So it's really important that you know where they might work optimally for your digestive purposes. And you can really mess that up by messing up your pH and your GI tract. So just to think about it, they work at certain temperatures too. They're optimal temperatures. They're optimal pH for different enzymes. You can see this one over here, pepsin, that would work in your stomach. Works at pH 2. It doesn't work at a higher pH, like 8 in your small intestine, but other enzymes do work in that environment. So just to kind of get the idea, you have lots of different enzymes. Some of those, when they're being made, they require metals. So you hear of people that might be zinc deficient or magnesium deficient. Why does it matter? But those enzymes need that metal to actually allow them to work, to function. It holds their structure, right? So just to kind of put that all in place. People that are zinc deficient, for example, have a very hard time drinking alcohol. And some of the people ended up in the hospital with lower, they don't just drink a little bit of alcohol and they have a real problem. And then they find out the reason was, it wasn't much alcohol, but they had a zinc deficiency. And so they could actually find out that they had a zinc deficiency and alcohol dehydrogenase wasn't working well. But also it's very important for this other enzyme we just talked about that's very critical for your pH and CO2, carbonic anhydrase. So it's kind of interesting, just be aware of it. So we just talked about proteins, about half of your cell weight is protein, and you've got these different structures. These just happen to be on standardized exams, so I'm going to cover it really quickly. Primary, general amino acids in a sequence, short chains, and amino acids binding together. And if you start to have an alpha helix or a beta sheet, those are called secondary. If you start to wind those together, and you can make where they fold on each other and maybe have two cysteines that bind together, and you can have a cysteine-cysteine bond, sulfur-to-sulfur bonding, like this. This is a tertiary structure. And when you have multiple proteins coming together, like hemoglobin, that's called primary, secondary, tertiary, quaternary. Okay, so now that you'll cover that, and hemoglobin is a good example for quaternary structure. All right, I'm not going to let you out early, don't worry. Okay, we have so much to get through. And all of these are online already. But just to quickly, I'm going to go through this kind of part just to get us all on the same page. And again, it's just review pretty much for most of us. So I don't want you to have to memorize every part of this, but just get the idea that cells are tightly joined together and they can then inhibit solutions from going between the cells, right? Our ions to go between the cells. Or amino acids from going between the cells, that they might have to be transported through the cell to get to the other side, like in your GI tract, for example. But you can have cell-cell communication through gap junctions. So these are important, small holes, basically, in the membrane that can allow small amino acids to go through, ions to go through, and electrical activity to go through, like your heart, right, for electrical activity. So those are important. A lot of work in understanding how membranes work really was with the frog skin preparations. Many people that were internal medicine clinicians, for example, that were interested in research, many of them are very focused on how the kidney works, and many of them actually did experiments in the old days on frog skin, which is pretty neat to think about. So where do frogs live? In the pond, right? Freshwater pond. What's going to happen to their salts in their body if they're in a freshwater pond? The salts want to go out, right? So it has to retain that, right? So it's going down a concentration to get rid of salts. So how does this animal keep the salts in it? And so people looked at how the frog skin works. By looking at frog skin, that actually made breakthroughs to understand how your kidneys work and how your GI tract works. So the early work that was done on frog skin, we have to credit them for understanding how you function, how mammals function, how you control ion balance. And so it's really quite neat. And you can imagine, there's a lot to this, and it's basically how they set this up. But from this, they understood a lot. And what they really, the take-home of this is that understanding where the pump is can drive so many things. Let's just look at the two sides here. If you had a sodium pump on this side, sodium potassium pump, and you're pumping sodium out all the time and potassium in, what's happening? You get low sodium here, right? And you get high potassium. So what's going to happen to the driving gradient for sodium to come across this membrane? Well, now you can allow sodium to come into the membrane over here, right into the cell, because you're driving it all the time by pumping it out on that side. But what's the key here? The membrane has to be permeable to the ion, right? It has to be permeable. If it's impermeable, it's not going to let the ion through. So it might be a leak channel. It might allow sodium to go through, but it has to go down a concentration gradient, right? So to keep that concentration gradient, it's driven by the sodium-potassium pump. And you can see here that, well, potassium's high, but this side of the membrane, this side of the cell, is not permeable to potassium. But this side is more permeable to potassium. So now what's going to happen? Potassium goes out this way. But it can be pumped back in, but it can go back out that way. So the take-home of that is, depending on where the transport molecules are or the pumps are, can change the whole gradient of how that cell works. And this is how we take ions in our GI tract. And water is going to follow what? The osmotic gradient, right? Okay. So get the idea of this transport mechanism. It might be, you know, this way, but it's not just through between the cells, but depending on where that pump is, can drive these processes. Okay. And then you think about other aspects about getting larger molecules through. It could be through specialized carrier proteins. And we'll just cover a little bit about that in the next chapter. So that wasn't so bad, right? So that was lecture two. Great stuff. All right. Lecture three. So if we get to here, neuron function, this is where we're beginning to really get into maybe some new material for you. And we do need to know the anatomy of a neuron and the general idea, and you'll need that on standardized exams too. But I don't want you to go away thinking that all neurons are shaped like this. There's really a lot of variation. But the general idea is, if you had a neuron in your spinal cord, let's call it your alpha motor neuron, the one that innervates your skeletal muscles, it would look something like this. In your spinal cord, you have these, you have these dendrites. This is where it receives other information from other neurons. The dendrites and integrate the signal onto the cell body. That electrical depolarization, graded responses, comes down to the site called spike initiation. I know this is a review from 152, but I'm just reminding you. But why is this a spike initiation? Anybody have 302? Neuro? Intra? Neuro? General? Yes, go for it. Why is that a spike initiation? What makes that a spike initiation region? Did you have your hand up? Oh, yeah, yeah. But you had 152, so now you're saying you had 152, so now you know the answer. You forgot. That's okay. It was the whole summer and Christmas break and all that stuff. Okay, so what spike initiation is? A high density of voltage-gated sodium channels, right? High density of voltage-gated sodium channels. So you depolarize just a little bit, those voltage-gated sodium channels sense that boom. They all open up, sodium rushes in, produces an action potential travels down the axon, goes down to the nerve terminals, and like we were just talking about, those nerve terminals are specialized. They then have voltage-gated calcium channels in the nerve terminal. We're going to hit this over and over again, so don't freak out if I'm going too fast. Voltage-gated calcium channels, they open up because they're voltage-gated. They then allow calcium to come in. Those vesicles that we talked about are inside that nerve terminal. They then fuse to the membrane, release the transmitter. If you didn't have botulinum toxin, right? Okay, so that's the point there. So try to remember this. A lot of aspects with that nerve, this is a single neuron. A nerve has many neurons. This is a single neuron, single cell. But is this the way all neurons really are? Let's think about this, for example. If you touch your skin, right, you can touch your skin, right? Don't touch your partner. You're not supposed to touch people. New things these days. Okay, so... if you touch your skin, you feel it, right? How is it that you're activating that touch receptor?
The pressure.
The pressure, What are you doing to make that fire?
Physically,
mechanistically. So your sensory endings, they're kind of like the dendrites of the cell. They're in your skin, but you're not putting a chemical on it, right? You're putting pressure on it. So how is it activating that sensory ending? How is it activating that dendrite? Here it's a synapse, but in your skin, Kaylee knows. Come on. The idea is physically something's happening. It could be sodium channels, it could be potassium channels, it could be calcium channels, and these are called stretch activated ion channels. Key thing to remember, stretch activated ion channels, all right? Mechanosensory channels, mechanically. So now the sensory ending, we call these sensory endings, not dendrites in your sensory cell. So these sensory endings, you pushed on them, and you opened up channels. Isn't that wild? That's wild, isn't it? So all the time, that's how you feel things. That's how if you touch a single hair and you move it around, you're opening up stretch-activated ion channels. It's causing a greater depolarization. Now think of this, that little ending. Let's take my fingers to this little ending that's up there like a dendrite. How is it, where are these proteins? These proteins, let's say that's the sensory ending. These proteins are embedded in that membrane. So when you push on the skin, you're actually stretching one side over here, right? And opening it up, sodium could be rushing in, just like the dendrites, causing a depolarization. But do you want that graded depolarization to travel? Is it going to travel all the way up into your spinal cord? Where's the cell body for this? Where's the cell body for that sensory? Is the cell body right out there underneath the skin? Where's your cell body for that sensory ending? It's your body. I need to know about your body. Where's that cell body? Any ideas? Spit it out. Is it up here?
Dorsal root ganglion.
Dorsal root ganglion. Now, is that in the spinal cord or is that outside the spinal cord? It's outside the vertebrae, right? It's outside the spinal cord. So they sit along the back side of your vertebrae, outside the spinal cord. So the cell body is way up there. So the cell body for that little neuron that I touched on my tip of my finger, on the tip of your toe, it has to travel all the way up to the dorsal root ganglion before the cell body is reached, and then it projects on into the spinal cord. So that's a bipolar cell, not like this. Just take that cell body and like move it way down here, right? That's kind of weird. So do we want a graded response in that sensory ending, a graded electrical response to travel all that distance? No. So this is where the misconception comes from. This is why I'm making a point about it. So in your sensory endings, like this, you have a high density of voltage-gated sodium channels right here close to the sensory ending. So now you can make an action potential very close to the sensory ending, make that action potential, that electrical event, travel all the way up the axon, past the dorsal root ganglion, and then into the spinal cord to then release transmitter. Okay? So not every neuron's the same way in the shape or in their function. So you have to kind of think about this. And these standardized types of figures you see in the textbooks can confuse you sometimes. That's why I go over it. A lot of work, just 1 minute, a lot of work was actually done on your favorite animal, secondary favorite animal, not just the crayfish, we'll talk about that, but this nasty thing, cockroaches, which you can see on the biology loading dock out there, if you're out there at night, you're going all over in the summer. But a lot of work was actually to understand integration in your central nervous system by this cockroach. Actually, Siba Geigy in Basel, Switzerland used this animal for 10 years or so to actually screen pharmacological agents they would use on humans. Right? Pretty interesting. Because the transmission here, the sensory neurons that go into that sixth abdominal ganglion, actually uses acetylcholine as a transmitter. And the receptors are acetylcholine receptors, like at your neuromuscular junctions and on your heart. So they would actually screen pharmacological agents on cockroaches. Isn't that kind of nasty? But they could screen many of them, and very cheaply, and then look at which drugs and how they're working, and then see if they would work on higher animals like mammals, rodents. Okay, so for those that have lab on Wednesday, what are you going to do tonight? Your quiz, and then Wednesday's lab, and then Thursday, We're going to probably cruise through a lot of this chapter on Thursday.